Well, hello everybody. Welcome to today's keynote speech here at LinuxTag 2012. Well, getting most out of your latest CPU features is always a little bit tricky, but it pays off if you do it right. There are a lot of great features in recent processors, but especially if it comes to parallelism, it may turn out to be tricky. So with some of the latest features in CPU technology, we have a couple of options that may, if done right, ease this pain. And therefore, I'm very honored and pleased that we have a keynote speaker, Ulrich Treppe, here, who has been taking care of the glibc library for many years and has also developed in several other parts of the Linux ecosystem. So please give a hand to Ulrich Treppe.
Thanks. All right. So thanks for the introduction. So you might wonder why someone from a stupid bank wants to talk to you about these things. So it's mostly about technology for me, and this is something which I've been actually working on for quite some time. And I just want to share this information with you. So it's not that this is unimportant for us as a firm. So it's really, really important. And I want to have people adopt this as quickly as possible. And this might actually need some headway. So the feature which I'm going to talk about today, mostly about the hardware features, are not really yet available. So they will be available in next year's processors. So they're called Haswell, the code name for them. And they're all about actually taking advantage of the computers and the processing power which is available through them. So the problem is, of course, that processors haven't sped up that much. So the single-core performance of the processors hasn't gone up really much over the last 5 years or something like this. So what has gone up is the total compute power of a CPU. So the number of cores, and also now again, hyperthreads and so on, which are available on the CPU, those have gone up. And you can only actually accelerate your programs in any significant amount if you take advantage of this additional functionality. So, but this is, of course, something which is actually pretty hard to do. So you can, and this is the old Unix philosophy, split up your program in many, many different parts and have them work independently of each other, feed them through pipelines, et cetera, which is an actually nice thing to do in many cases because the only thing which you're depending on, the only interfaces which you're creating are those which are exposed through the pipelines or something like this or other file formats on disk, et cetera. Which is a nice thing, but it comes at a cost. At the very least, you have to do some marshaling between the different stages. So in the form of serializing code which goes over pipelines or in some form of file format in which you store the data on a file system, et cetera. So these kind of things have to do, and this is eating up quite significantly in performance. Especially, and this is goes back to what I'm mostly interested in these days, is it's actually something which is increasing latency. So the low latency applications cannot really be implemented using these models of having multiple processes, et cetera. So we need to have actually something done differently. So, and this differently is not something new. This is something which has existed for a very long time, of course. Now, this means we are doing parallel programming. So parallel programming in the sense of either having multiple processes working through shared memory or having multiple threads inside the same process, et cetera. But I imagine that everyone who has done these kind of things will say, or hopefully agree, that this is something which is very hard and which is something which is something which is less than optimal to do with today's programming environments. So we have two ways of actually doing this. So we can still do things using multiple processes, but then for efficiency reason, if we don't want to do marshalling, etc., we have to use shared memory systems. Or we use multiple threads, in which case all using the POSIX thread model, all the memory which is in the system, in the process, is shared by all the threads, and therefore we have very easy and very efficient communication going on. Both of these alternatives really have one problem. It's really error-prone programming, because regardless of what you do, if you share memory with in the different tasks, you have to have some form of synchronization going on. And unfortunately, in the world we are living right now, where people think that actually threads are the right way of abstracting things, as opposed to much more advanced mechanisms like futures, etc. So with threads, you have the problem that you actually have to do locking. Locking is the thing which is the bane of all programming. That's the thing which is preventing us from actually making progress. So the problem with locking is that, of course, the lock is taken. If another thread tries to take it, get the same lock, it's preventing from doing this. That's the nature of a mutex. Mutual exclusion is exactly, it's in the name. And the higher the contention level for locking is, the lower the parallelization level. And this is what Amdahl expresses in the law, which is named after him. And, well, this is my version of this. It's a little bit extended version of this. So P stands in this case for the level of the program, or the percentage of the program which can be parallelized. And the higher P is, the more efficiently can a program run. So if you, as the example shows here in this case, have something like 60% parallelizable code, which seems high at that point, perhaps for many cases, you can throw as many processes at the whole thing. You never get any significant speed up. So here you can see we can throw up to 16 threads on the same thing with tiny little parallelization costs, which I have added there, and you can hardly scratch a 2x speed up. So this is really a problem to take advantage of the machine. Having multiple cores working at the same time, working on the same problem, we have to increase the level of parallelization in the program. We can rewrite the code, which we have completely entirely using new paradigms which are out there, and this is something which should be done in future, which is something which programming languages like C++ get now support for. I already mentioned futures. Futures are based on threat pools, etc., so the implementations, and which to some extent will do away with all these kind of things and let the programmer concentrate on actually writing code in a way where the implicit code definitions are defining the synchronization points, and therefore programmers don't have to worry about locking anymore, and the system is responsible for actually creating the level of parallelism. But as I said, we are not there. We are not using this. We are using threads today, and threads are using locking, and locking means reduction of parallelization, which means we cannot achieve any speed up. There's really not any reasonable way to do this. So there's not really something which with today's systems where we can just do away with locking. There are alternatives where we have atomic data structures, etc., and we have potentially technologies which are also used in the kernel, something like, for instance, recopy update, RCU. We can use these, but this is not a general solution in general. Especially also because each of these additional technologies, if we are using them, will increase the cost of actually parallelization. So this is the green factor which I have there, which is the thing which I added to this formula. There is something. There's always a cost. If you throw more cores at the problem, there's always going to be an incremental cost to each and every one of them, which means that at some point you actually do not only have to look at increasing the parallelization, you also have to look at reducing the cost of actually performing the parallelization. So what do we have to do? So I already said we have to collaborate in shared memory. That's the only way we can do this for high performance and low latency. And the synchronization access today is done using locking. So we have a couple of atomic data structures out there, which are based on mostly a specific instruction which most CPUs are implementing nowadays, which is called compare and swap or compare and exchange in some on some systems. So in short, most people are abbreviating this as CAS, so C-A-S from the first letters, which you can see there. And this is a very powerful instruction. It has been shown by in some academic papers, mostly by Hurley and so on, that just implementing CAS allows us to implement all the available data structures in an atomic way. So why atomic data structures? Why would they be better? So the thing is, if you have an atomic data structures, you don't have to do any locking, which means that all the changes which have to be made for a data structure will become available at the same time to every other thread which is running the same process, and therefore, well, if it all becomes available, there's no situation where we can have an intermediate results. An intermediate result from before we actually do the change to after we do the change. If we have lengthy operations in the middle, any other thread can read an intermediate result which is not corresponding to any valid state. So with atomic data structures, we are preventing this. So these are nice things. So as I said, we can implement them using a CAS instruction. And at the bottom here, you see pseudocode, which is implementing this. So you don't really have to necessarily understand everything which I say here so about this. But in general, it is you provide it with a pointer to a memory location. You provide it with an old value, and you provide it with a new value. And the semantic of the function of the instruction is that the content of the memory location will be changed to the new value, but only if the current value is that of the old value. So it sounds simple, but it's really sufficient. So the good news is, already said, that pretty much all architectures are providing this kind of instruction nowadays. The bad news is that it's really not sufficient to implement many data structures. And here I have just listed a couple of them in this table. So we have a couple of data structures like LIFOs, FIFOs, hash tables, linked lists, or single linked lists, and double linked lists. And they can be further categorized as priority lists, so which means that each entry which you add has a certain priority and they have to be sorted. And then you can categorize them by the number of readers and by the number of writers each of these data structures has. So with a single simple CAS instruction, there are only a handful of these variants which can actually be implemented. And I have filled them in here in the table, so I'm not going to list them all, so spell them out. So, but in general, you can pretty much implement LIFOs in many situations, but even FIFOs you can only have in a very few situations actually implement using a CAS instruction, and none of the others whatsoever. But if you look at your average program out there, this is definitely not sufficient. Most programs are using more sophisticated data structures, especially hash tables are terribly important, because they provide mostly a deterministic performance. They're providing the low latency requirements, fulfilling the low latency requirements which we need, etc. And therefore, anything which cannot implement hash tables in an atomic fashion is not really a solution. So the x86 processors, both 30-bit and 64-bit, have one additional instruction out there which is useful in some situations. So it is not a double CAS, it's a double white CAS instruction. So what this means is that it has an instruction which instead of modifying one word, it modifies two words. But, and that's the big but here, the two words have to be following each other in memory. So with that, we can implement a couple more data structures in an atomic way, so some of the FIFO variants, but that's it again. None of the others are actually affected by this, which led people to demand for many years. So there was really a discussion for 15, 20 years where people were saying, yeah, you see how powerful the CAS instructions are. Give us more of that. Give us a double CAS. Give us a triple CAS. And that's the slippery road which people found themselves in. So they were experimenting with double cast implementation. So which double cast in this situation means that you have two memory locations, you have two old values and two new values, and the effects of this will be available through one instruction atomically at the same time. So this obviously could have solved a couple more situations. So probably on the rest of the LIFO and FIFO situations could have been solved, etc. So, but not much else of this table. So there, it's not a real solution. So then where people are thinking, yeah, maybe we need a triple cast. So with triple cast, we can again implement a couple more situations, perhaps. But it still is no solution for the whole problem. It's not a problem. It's not a solution which can actually lead us to actually achieving, in general, exploitation of the parallelization which is now available in the systems. So there's a nice paper, actually, which has been written quite some time ago by a couple of guys from Sun. It's called DCAS is not the silver bullet for non-blocking algorithm design. So I highly encourage you to read this if you're interested in this kind of topic. So it's basically was the end of the discussion when this kind of thing was made. So this actually set the point of says, well, forget all these kind of extensions. There will not be a double word cast. There will not be a triple cast, etc. They are not really a solution for anything. We need something else. We need something completely different. We need something which actually can do away with locking in the first place. So locking itself is really the bane of programming. This is the part which is creating the bugs in the program most of the time, because you can test your program as much as possible, as much as you want. You will not recreate all the race conditions which actually might exist when the program when the program is then run for real. Especially because, as it happens most of the time, in the situation when developers are writing their code, it does not nearly reflect, in many cases, the situations in which the actually end users are running the code them in. So to some extent, the developers really don't have nearly as much hardware access, for instance. So don't have networks which are as fast as perhaps they exist in the deployment phase, etc. So locking itself, it will always leave the programs open for bugs which are related to perhaps lock inversion or other issues which are related just specific to locking. The other thing is that we have problems with the actual design of libraries. So if you take a look, for instance, at the C++ standard, which defines a lot of container data structures which programmers can use. So how are they specified? Well, they are specified in ignorance of locking. They assume that the caller of these the functions, the methods for all these data structures, is taking care of locking, so which means they are using explicit locking. Well, which makes them harder to use. And it also means that the code which is necessary to actually generate this is going to be larger, because every single call site, you have to do locking around this. But it's the decision has been made to actually do this because there's a problem with the inverse. So if we do implicit locking, which means that, for instance, if we're calling into a function to add something to a hash table, we're first getting a lock for this hash table instance, et cetera, do the operation, then unlock. Well, what do you do then in situations, for instance, if you want to take an element which is queued up in one list and add it to another list and do this atomically, which means that no thread can ever see, come into a situation where the element, so the element which we are moving from the list, is not at some point in at least one of these two lists, well, or more correctly, in exactly one of these lists. So if we are using implicit locking, you would have remove it from one list, then the second thread can come in and try to look for the element, and it would be gone. It would be found nowhere. So for these kind of situations, you would have to create another explicit lock around it. So this is simply not acceptable. So there have been many attempts to fix these kind of situations over the years. There are libraries which have provided locking and non-locking versions of their interfaces. There are versions where you can specify attributes for data structures and say, yeah, here's a lock. Do the locking for me implicitly. So none of this really solves the issue, because in the end, whether we're doing explicit locking or not, we run into problems with the semantics of the locks. And especially if we're trying to avoid the problems in the code which the user has to write, we will then sooner or later run in what is called the ABBA locking problem, so which means it's a deadlock. So as an example, imagine how would a move function be implemented in C++, where you have to move from one list to another list. So you have to take the implicit lock from the source, you have to take the implicit lock from the target data structures, and then do the moving. But what happens if someone else at the same time is trying to move an element the other direction? In that case, you might have first, in the first thread, take the lock of data structure A, the second thread takes the lock of data structure B, then the first thread again tries to take the lock for data structure B and locks and has to wait because the second thread has done it. And the second thread at the same time will have to try to get the lock for data structure A and will wait again. So we have a deadlock, nothing works. This is a very, very common situation. This is something which people run into every single time, which is the reason why we don't have general implicit locking. So this is what is called a composability problem, where you simply cannot use implicitly locking interfaces and just compose them, use them in higher level functions which are working on top of these data structures. So how do you do these kind of things then? There has to be something better. There has to be something which is completely doing away with this, otherwise people will have to continue to write serial code, and which means we cannot take advantage of the parallelization the machines are providing us with. So there's one thing in addition to the locking problem per se, and I already mentioned that's the thing which I'm nowadays are mostly interested in, that's the latency associated with this. Even if you do the locking correctly, you always have the problem that if there's contention around the lock, you have a latency attached to the problem of waking the second thread up once the first thread is done with its work and has actually released the lock. So it might seem that this is a small thing. This is a small amount of time which is actually being paid. But the wake-up signal up to the point when the woken thread can actually continue is determined by all kinds of things. So there's the work which the awaker has to do inside the kernel most of the time to actually access data structures to find where the lock is, etc. And then there is the even bigger problem that the woken thread actually has to be scheduled again. So if the thread is not already running on the CPU, which in this case it isn't, it has to get its new turn of actually getting a core to actually execute on, and this might actually take some while. So these scheduling delays are actually contributing a huge part of the entire latency of operations of low latency programs, because there's no way for the program to actually, well, minimize or actually eliminate this. Yeah, we can have pinning of processes with our threads. We can actually increase priorities of them so that the scheduler actually gets the hint and says, yeah, I'm important, schedule me first. But it's not completely eliminating this, and this might actually take a while, and especially when you combine this whole thing with a NUMA-aware scheduler, where you have resource constraints around the CPUs, where you might have a thread not being run right away because its home node is full, but a remote node might not be completely full. There might be compute functionality available on that node. The scheduler will try to avoid these kind of things. So there's all kinds of nightmares associated with this. So it's, again, a problem which is caused by locking and which cannot really be solved with without completely abolishing locking or completely changing how it works. So that's a depressing part of the talk, and that's a part which we have lived through until now, and which is something which is really the research agenda for many, many different groups out there. So we have been looking for ways around this kind of thing for now 30 years probably, ever since the threading model came up. And finally, we have some light on the horizon to actually eliminate this in some situations at least. So we have with the next year's process, which are coming out from Intel, two complementary approaches coming up. They're all available with this new processor version, but they're actually targeting different things. So the first thing is we have an implementation which allows us to improve the locking implementation by itself. So just improve it. So it will reduce contention, it will reduce also the cost of the individual operations. And then there's a second part, which is has a much higher goal, and this is completely changing the way we're doing locking. So this is a much higher goal and requires a lot more more change going forward, but it is something which will hopefully in the end actually have the much higher payoff. So Intel is having the moniker, so the Actron TSX assigned to all the technologies in there, but underneath there, the two technologies which I'm talking about are hardware lock elision. So I'm going to call this HLE. And the other one is transactional memory support. So it's actually called RTM. It's restricted transactional memory support. It's called RTM. And I'm going to talk about both of them. So I'm concentrating mostly on the HLE part because this is the part which is, at this point in time, a little bit more visible. The RTM part will require integration with the rest of the ecosystem. And we have not yet, at least I don't have yet, much of an insight as to what the benefit of the performance of the implementation, how it will look like. So I will talk about this in the end a little bit. But the HLE part is for me, at least in the moment, the more interesting part. So what we will get out of these kind of technologies is, as I said, I'm going back to the graph which I've already shown you in the beginning. We can actually increase the parallelization level. And just bumping the parallelization level from, say, 60% to 80% will allow us to speed up the program quite significantly, as you can see here. It also will allow us to simplify some of the code out there. So, for instance, currently we're having programs out there which are optimized by using different locks for different situations. So, for instance, if you have a data structure which is mostly read and only rarely written to, well, we're using nowadays something called reader-writer locks, which are a special version of mutexes out there. So they are more complicated to implement. They are slower in execution by itself, so the actual implementation, but they permit more parallelization going on. So the good thing about the HLE technology, which I'm going to talk about, is that, well, we will get this for free. We don't have to do anything. We can go back to using normal locks, and they will behave if the program is in the category which wants us to use reader-writer locks. It will actually automatically behave like this. So, and just by... In many situations, just by making a couple of changes to the basic runtime, which you will automatically get by updating the appropriate libraries, you will see that some programs will automatically run a little bit faster, run a little bit more parallel. Because the HLE technology especially is completely transparently done. So there's not really much you have to do yourself. Unless you actually want to, unless you actually write data structures, etc. And one other thing, even better thing, is that you can actually start writing the code like this today, because the actual encoding of all these kind of instructions is backward compatible. So you can actually generate code which is using HLE today. It will work, correct semantic, and as soon as you have a new processor running it, suddenly runs faster. So let's go through the actual code. I have a running example for that. So we are going to look at the problem of hash tables, which are really the the poster child for these kind of technologies. Hash tables are by design meant to be used in parallel. So they are designed so that that concurrent accesses are not really touching the same memory locations unless you have the same key for the hash table. You also have most of the time the situation that the hash table is read more often than written to. So all these kind of situations are perfectly suited for the introduction of HLE and other technologies, so atomic operations on data structures. And they are currently crippled by the current technology out there. So I'm going to make a lot of simplifications in here. So I'm, in this example, not talking about cache lines. So I'm going to mention them at some point. So the operations we are going to talk about for the individual instructions are actually working on cache lines and not on individual memory locations. But you should get the idea from this. Just keep in mind that in reality, it's a little bit more complicated than just what I present here in the simplified example. So let's go through the actual process of working with the hash table. And before we actually go look at the assembly code, which I've written for that, let's take a look at the semantic of how we actually have to implement a securely locked access to a data structure, to a hash table data structure. So and this is just a state diagram, which should be easy enough to read. So on the right side, you see the states which are representing accessing the data structures for reading or writing, etc. In the middle, you see two states which are corresponding to actually managing the locking. So we, in one case, and in the top, so in the top middle circle there, you have the situation where you want to take the lock. And actually, well, if it's available, we actually take it. And then the bottom, we are releasing the lock. And the two states on the left side are responding to, well, if the lock is currently taken, we have to delay and wait until it becomes available. And the opposite on the bottom side is that we have to wake someone up if we have just released the lock. So that's the usual way the programs are going through the motion of actually using a hash table or any other data structure which is protected by a lock. So there are a couple of things I want to point to. So the implementation of the locking instruction is, at least for an x86 process, mostly done using the simple CAS instruction. So in this case, I'm simplifying it a bit. It is the real implementation you can find of mutexes is a little bit more tricky than this, but it's sufficient for this talk to imagine that the locking instruction is just a CAS instruction, which assumes if the current value is zero, I'm replacing it with one. If this operation succeeds, we have gotten the lock. If it's not succeeding, we are back to the delay and have to wait until the lock is freed. So assume all that. It's very easy to hopefully see that this isn't a valid implementation of a mutex. So the second thing I want you to realize is that we are operating on two different memory areas here. So we have the mutex memory here, and we have the hash table memory and some other parts. So they are not, in general, you can assume they are really separate areas. And particularly, there's something special about the mutex if you take a look at the implementation, which I spelled out here. The thing is that the state of the mutex from before a successful locking to after the unlock operation, the effective change is nothing. That's a terribly important thing in this case. So we are in the release operation for the mutex. We are storing again zero in the mutex, which brings us back to the stage with signals to the next logger the mutex is available. So keep in mind, this is a very, very important thing. And it's true for pretty much all lock implementation. There are potentially other implementation possible. This is not an issue, not a problem with the existing implementation with existing hardware, but if these implementations want to take advantage of the new technology, specifically the HLE technology in future, they have to change the implementation to something which looks like this. So we have to get to a stage where the prior and the post state of the mutex is basically the same. We're not talking about the state of the hash table. So I already said this is a different different memory area. So that part is left out. We're only talking about the mutex at this point. So let's now come to the HLE part. So it's falling nicely in this thing. And it all starts with the basic question, what if the one, which is normally written through the CAS instruction, is not actually committed to memory, is not made visible to all the other threads which are running on in the system? So the answer which you should give at this point is, well, the program will misbehave, because you actually can have more than one thread running through the whole system, running through the mutex operation here, and succeed and actually come out. So in this case, for instance, you have shown here two threads. Both of them will pass the mutex operation, and one of them will read something, and another one will update something in the hash table, and the result might be that they read inconsistent state. So this is something which, in theory, so really, well, this what is what a mutex is supposed to prevent, and this is which means that just ignoring the store of the one into the memory location is not really solving anything. But there's one key thing here which you should recognize, is that the hash table has its own memory locations. And there's one piece in the processor which already keeps track of these kind of things. The cache is the one, so the CPU caches, especially the level one cache on a CPU like Intel, which has an inclusive cache, which means every single memory location which the processor is touching has to get into the level one cache. So with these kind of CPU architectures, it is mandatory that every memory location which the CPU touches gets in the memory, and therefore we can recognize that if we are touching the same memory location as part in two different threads, as part of under the protection of a lock, we can do something. We can actually find out why what is going on there. We can potentially say something happened. It's not anymore, the mutual exclusion is not anymore guaranteed. And this is actually what is behind all this kind of technology, all this hype around HLE, etc. This is not something, and I want to take something of the credit away from Intel. Intel didn't really invent this. This comes from someone else. There's a guy called Maurice Hurley. He's a professor at Brown University, and he has written a paper about this a long time ago, so in the early 90s, when he was still working at DEC. So this has been around for a long time. It just took a long time to actually get to us now to in a useful stage. So in summary, what we can do with this is the original situation, just ignoring the one, is really not useful. But we can actually find out through the CPU mechanisms whether the concurrent access is creating any harm. If the two concurrent threads are not touching the same memory location, or if both threads are just doing reads, there is no conflict. There's an operation which operates on, so which is necessary for the operation of the caches. So the caches are implementing using a protocol called MESI, or there are no extended MESI protocols, but in the simplest form, it's an MESI protocol. And there's an operation which the caches are implementing. It's called a request for ownership operation. So the only thing we have to see is, what the processors have to see is, do we actually create an RFO request as part of these lock elision? If we are doing this, then we have problems. We have to do something about this. If we are not creating any RFO requests as part of these the lock operations, so on the protection of the lock, then we have no problem. So we can actually, therefore, we can detect collisions, or the CPU can detect collisions by just looking at the RFO requests. And as already said, CPU caches already do this. They have done this for the last 15, 20 years now. It's just we piggyback something else on top of this. And this is what we are getting now to in the Intel HED implementation. So let me say, Intel doesn't document this at this level. I have no further insight, knowledge into actually what the CPUs are doing. This is all coming from the documentation they have released and the understanding of how these kind of things are working internally. So there are some things here which I'm explaining, but they are not exactly as the CPU will implement this. So there are the specification of the HED part, for instance, I think is still not sufficient from what Intel is providing it so far. So I'm talking to these guys. But it gives you a brief impression of actually how it looks like. And well, unfortunately, at this level, because I want to talk actually about the CPU features, I have to expose you to a little bit of assembly code. So not talking about assembly at this point makes this a really wishy-washy talk, so I don't want to do this. So this is unfortunately a little bit of assembly, but I'm keeping it very, very brief and very short, and I'm actually explaining this ahead of time. So here you see a couple of different things. On the right side, you see the different memory locations which I've been talking about. So the memory for the hash tables, memory for the mutex. On the left side, you see two boxes which are corresponding to the threads. Each of the threads has a little bit of code attached to them. And then what these colored bars are, they are supposed to represent the cache, the level one cache of the thread. So there, we have a couple of different instructions which you see there. So the compare and exchange instruction, that's the CAS instruction which I've been talking about. So the rest, the lock, forget that. That's just to make it atomic. So the important thing is the CAS instruction. The next one is an instruction which tests for the success of the locking instruction, of the compare and exchange instruction, and it jumps somewhere in case it was not successful. In this case, we have to delay, we have to wait until someone is it. The next instruction is a move instruction, which is just storing, reading something in this case. So the move table plus 2 into EDX loads value from memory into a register. And the last two instructions are the unlock instructions for the mutex. That's it. It's very simple. So it's not really that interesting. So this is code which you can execute today, which will work if you fill in the blanks, and which implements a simple mutex. So with the HLE part now, there is something new coming. A couple of additional pieces are made available in the CPU itself. So first of all, we have a couple of instruction prefixes, as they are called. So the lock is already a prefix. We can now attach additional prefixes. And one of them is called X-acquire. The other one is called X-release. So I don't know where the X comes from, but that's what Intel has released them under. So X-acquire, X-release are extensions of an existing instruction. In this case, the X-acquire means it's the beginning of a lock elision region. And the X release, obviously, is this is the end of a lock elision. That's it. So that's the only change we have to do. And I already mentioned that these instruction prefixes, as they exist now, are completely backward compatible. So you can actually write code like this, if you have a recent enough toolchain on your system, compile it and run it on your machine, and it will work. It's just that with the new processors from next year, you will actually be able to run this code and take advantage of HLE. So that's the nice thing about this. So we have a couple of more things which are actually changing in there. And again, this is not really the detail of how the CPU does it. This is just a logical extension. So the way you can imagine them, how they are implemented. So we have now also a couple of additional flags per cache line. And these cache lines this is the granularity at which memory is handled by the CPU. So each cache line gets a flag which says, is this part of a transaction, and is this transaction still valid? So that's it. So we have, it's a very simple implementation there. So I imagine Intel might just actually implement this with one single bit per cache line. So it's not really that much additional work which has to be done actually in implementation of the silicon. And the last thing which is new is a log hash. It doesn't have to be implemented exactly this way. It's from the logical point of view, this is basically a location where we're remembering things about the log, the instruction which is starting a log elision area. So it also has to store things like where's the address of the instruction, but it also has to store things like what is the old value of the memory location of the which has been elided through the start of the log elision. So how does this all now play together? So this was all perhaps a little bit new and a little bit confusing. So we're going through the example now a couple of times, or actually two times, and I will explain some of these in a little bit more detail. So the first thing is a case where we have actually no collision. So a hash table with no collision, for instance, which can happen if we're having just read operations, or if have a read and the write operation is not touching the memory which is needed for the read operation. So if you have that, in this case here, so we have a specific memory location in a hash table where we have a fixed value in it, and the first thread is reading this memory. And the second thread is writing something in the table at a different memory location. And again, so I have, in this case, simplified the situation significantly in that I'm not talking about cache lines, I'm talking about memory locations. So every single, let's say, memory location has 4 bytes in size, and that's it. This is not what reality is, but bear with me, it's much simpler this way. So if we're executing this code now, so the first thing which happens with HLE enabled is that the locking operation succeeds in this case. So the old value of the mutex is 0, as you can see there, so at the bottom right. So what now happens, because we have the exacquire prefix added to it, is that the result of the operation, the compare and exchange operation, the CAS instruction here, is not actually committed to memory. Instead, internal data structures, which are representing the beginning of a HLE region, are filled up. It will say things like, the old value of this mutex, of this memory location, was 0. And the local cache, the local level 1 cache, will contain the appropriate cache line with the value 1 in it. And the appropriate transaction flag of the cache line is set. So, if now the second thread tries and I'm going on with thread 1 first, another step. So now it's a normal move operation, and I'm loading a value from the hash table, from the actual memory, into the level 1 cache and then into a register, in this case the EDX register. And the one thing which you see here is that the value we're loading from memory is moved into a cache line, which is also tagged with the transaction flag, because currently we are executing a transaction. So that's all very similar to what would normally be executed, except that the value of the mutex operation is not actually committed to memory. And this is what we can see now. So take a look at what happens if the first instruction of thread 2 is executed. So it's a similar operation as what has to be done for thread 1, and that is the compare and exchange instruction to actually change the value of the mutex. So, but in this case, what normally happens is that the CPU, so the core, the core which is actually is used to execute thread 2, will ask around on the entire system, does anyone have the current content for this cache line? And normally, if the transaction flag for this cache line would not be set in the level 1 cache for thread 1, thread 1 would say, I have the context. But now it is marked as part of a transaction and therefore is not yet globally visible. It will not answer to this request, and therefore thread 2 will actually get the cache line from memory, from main memory, and there the value is still 0. The result is that even though thread 1 currently has the mutex locked, thread 2 also can lock the mutex. And it, therefore, it can also continue and execute the move instruction. It can store the value 4 in the fifth entry of the hash table. But here, again, because we are part of a transaction, the value is not yet committed to main memory. So I've shown this here by making the line from the cache line, which has the value 4 in it, a dashed line to the appropriate entry in the hash table. This value is not yet globally visible. So only if we are now executing the appropriate release instruction, so going back to thread 1, will something happen. But before we actually, the CPU can actually execute the release instruction, it has to check, well, is the transaction valid? And there are a couple of different things which have to happen. First of all, the transaction must not have been aborted. In this case, it hasn't. The second thing is that the value we are storing now in the memory location has to be exactly the same as the value which previously was in there. And this is where these additional fields which you see there and in the box of thread 1 is for. So in this case, the move instruction tries to store 0 in the mutex, and this is, by coincidence or not, also exactly the value which is in the current cache for the HLE region. Therefore, the X release instruction, so the move instruction with the X release prefix, actually can benefit, succeed, and voila, it does, it will succeed. And as part of this release instruction, what happens is that the transaction flags of all the cache lines will be removed. So the value of the cache line which contained the mutex will be changed to 0 because this is now the value which is supposed to be. But more importantly, the cache line which has the 42 in it will also now be declared a normal cache line, not part of a transaction. So if any other core in the future tries to read this cache line or modify this cache line, it has to get has this thread at least discard this cache line. So it is now a valid cache line. More importantly now, or more complicated, for the second thread, if you take a look at this, the second thread also will succeed in its X-release instruction because the old content is still 0 of the mutex, and therefore it can succeed. The transaction hasn't been aborted. But as a side effect now of the release instruction, the value 4 gets made available in the main memory. Because now the transaction flag of the cache line which contains this value 4 gets removed. So now take a look, take a step back and think about what we have done here now. So we have a hash table which has to be protected by a mutex because there might be concurrent accesses and some of them are write accesses. But still, we have two threads which are working completely in parallel and working on the same hash table, and still we get the same semantic. This is exactly what we want. We have increased the parallelization level here in this case by 100%. So this is all nice, and in this case, everything worked fine. But the more critical part is actually, how does it work if we cannot use concurrency successfully using HLE. So with that, we go back to the same example, except we have a tiny little change in that the thread 2 is actually modifying the same memory location as thread 1 is reading. So it's everything else is exactly the same, so I can actually go through this a little bit faster. So the locking happens as before, and the thread 1 is reading the same memory location again in the same way, so we have now 42 again in the cache. It's marked as part of the transaction, all as before. But now what happens if the second thread comes along and actually does the same thing? So does its work? So locking still succeeds. This is as it has worked before. Everything as in the previous example. But now the thing is, if it now, the second thread, executes the second instruction, so the move instruction, this will target the same cache line as the first thread has read. So in this case now, the transaction for the first thread will fail. So it will be marked as failed. Let's phrase it this way. So this means that There's some status words somewhere in the CPU. I just indicated this using these red crosses there, which you can see there, so it doesn't have to be implemented like this. But there's some indication in the thread one now that it says the transaction failed. So why has thread one learned about this? And this is, again, what I talked before. This is part of the caching implementation, because in this case, before thread 2 can actually write to the memory location, which is table plus 2, it has to load the content in its level 1 cache, and for that it has to ask around, does anyone have the content of table plus 2, the memory location? Give it to me, I want to be the new owner. So this is what this RFO request is for, this request for ownership, and this is the indication for thread 1. Well, I've lost. My transaction is aborted. So what now can happen is that when the thread 1 now tries to execute the X3D instruction, it will fail because there's this information available. Has the transaction succeeded? No, it has not. Therefore, we have to do something now. Remember, if we just leave it like this, we get wrong semantics, so we get the wrong value, potentially. So what HLE is specified to do is to restart the application, the HLE region, completely automatically. You don't have to change anything. So the CPU keeps enough information in it so that the program counter can be reset to the beginning of the HLE region, and the cache content, etc., gets very, very easily and very simply be made up to date by simply forgetting every single cache line which has the transaction bit set. Remember, none of these values have been written to main memory, and therefore the previous state hasn't been changed. And if we come across the same memory location, we just load it back from main memory. That's very simple. But this exposes now one detail about the implementation, at least about the current implementation, and that is that the size of the code which can actually be executed under the HLE region is limited. In this case, it is limited by the size of the level 1 cache. So for every single load instruction, we have to load it in into the level 1 cache and set the flag for the cache line, for transaction, etc., etc. But this fills up the cache over time. And if we would not have enough memory in the cache, normally what happens is this information gets pushed to the next higher level cache, the level 2 cache. But this is not an option because the level 2 cache probably in the moment doesn't have this transaction information, this additional flags in it, which means that at that point we stop the transaction, we actually run into capacity problems of the transactions. But the good news is that the level 1 data cache on the CPU is today 32 kilobytes with 64 bytes for each cache line. This means 512 individual memory locations can actually be handled, which is a large thing. So imagine we have now a compare and exchange instruction which can handle 512 memory locations. So that's good enough in most cases. So continuing this example, now assume thread 2 is executing its next instruction, which is the release instruction. This one will succeed because the transaction hasn't failed. The old value is 0, which is exactly the value which we're writing to it, and it will succeed, and therefore will remove the transaction flag from all the memory locations, which means that implicitly the value of the memory location which has been written to, so table plus 2 in this case, is actually committed to main memory. So now so this thread is now done with its work now. We have to go back to thread 1. And now thread 1 is again executing the lock instructions, the compare and exchange instruction. So there comes now the twist with the way HLE is implemented. So the second time around, the hardware lock elision is elided. It's not done. So we're actually doing normal locking in this case. So this is, in this case, represented by, well, not filling in the stereo structure for the cache, but instead the value 1, which we're writing to now, is in main memory. So if we would now have thread 2 coming at this point again, it will actually have to wait because we actually are doing locking. So obviously under this semantic, we are completely alone and everything will just succeed. So the access to the memory will succeed and then also the releasing of the lock, in which case, in this case here, the X release is completely ignored because no transaction is going on at this point. It will succeed, etc. So with that, you can see that we can actually, with this tiny little change in the semantic of how the processor implements this, we can recognize the collisions which we might have in the data structures and at the same time automatically handle the collision side. So what I spelled out here as a semantic of this is one possible implementation. So Intel is very, very careful in not going into too many details about the actual implementation. So, for instance, I described it as if the second thread is always the one which succeeds. There's no guarantee for that. So in some situation, perhaps the first thread will succeed and the second one will fail. The other thing is the restart. When does it actually happen? Does it happen when the X release is executed? Does it happen earlier? So these are details of the implementation which are not necessarily important for everyone to know. This is what I described. The high level is what you should think about when you're looking for ways where you want to actually potentially use HLE. It's very simple to do. So there are other things, and also one other thing which can potentially be changed. I think the current implementation calls for the second iteration around to be using hardware lock, not using hardware lock collision. You could imagine that this is not the case. You could imagine that that it tries a couple of times with hardware lock collision, and then it actually falls back to performing the lock operation. There's also possibility that Intel will implement caches for hardware lock collision, where it remembers, did this HLE region the last time succeed? If not, I'm not even bothering with trying to execute it with hardware lock collision, because as you can see from the walking through the example here, if you fail to execute the HLE region successfully, you are going to execute it twice, therefore reducing the overall performance of your code. So there are all kinds of things which can be done in future better, which certainly will be, as soon as we get a little bit of experience with writing code for this, Intel can write much better processes and actually improve the implementation. So that's something which a lot of research will go into in the next years. So what are the benefits of HLE? So, and hopefully you already got the idea. It's mostly about data structures. It's about atomic data structures. So having a lock of some form and having it applied. And if you're looking at the table now, so we can pretty much fill out the table now. So there are a couple of asterisks there, though. So for hash tables, for LIFOs and FIFOs, we can say that, there's no problem. We can actually implement all kinds of data structures now using HLE in a completely lock-free way. That's a very simple way. For hash tables, I added a little asterisk there because there's a little problem, and that is how you deal with collisions in a hash table. Usually, you should not have too many collisions in a hash table because this means that your size of the hash table or the prime numbers or whatever the size, the hash values you're using are not really good. And therefore, the performance of the hash table is actually reduced. So in general, hopefully, you will not have any problems because you have to run, as already said, you have to look into the data structure. You have to touch more than 500 memory locations to actually run out of capacity of the HLE cache for the transformation, for the HLE operation to fail. So this is something which should hopefully not happen, but we might have to design data structures a little bit more differently than we are doing it right now. So we might actually have to guarantee that certain limits are not exceeded. So we might have to see that certain the hash chaining, etc., will not touch more than 500 elements. And if yes, then we might have to restructure the hash tables, etc. So the other thing is it becomes important to how we are laying out the data structures. So just to give an impression how, for instance, what is called external hashing is usually be implemented. So with external hashing, you have the hash table contain a pointer to an element, and if this is not the element you are looking for, the data structure contains a pointer to a next element, etc. So currently, people are not spending too much thought and to, unfortunately, designing these kind of data structures. But if you need, let's say, two cache lines or more to actually do the perform the operation of comparing the key of the hash table lookup with your search key and walking, then going on to the next element of the chain, if this takes two or three or four cache lines to actually implement this kind of thing, then the size, the maximum size of the hash collision chain in this case will actually be brought down from 512 entries to 128. So if you have four, so this will become important, and it's even more important in for the list examples. So lists by their nature are probably long. So unless they're not really well used, so many people are actually not using lists in a very efficient way. But if lists are long, and you are searching from the beginning and for the right place to insert something or for the right element to extract from a list, you can very easily run into a large number of these list elements before you find what you're looking for. So the result here is that it becomes important not only to optimize the lookup path, so optimized where the way you're storing the keys in the data structures and how you go on to the next element, but it can also potentially be possible, also important to select a different implementation altogether. So having a simple list might, you have to touch every single element which is in the list. So perhaps you have to redesign your data structures to use something like skip lists, where you walk more efficiently to the next element. So instead of visiting every single element in the list, you might skip 10 in the middle and then go on. So there are more efficient data structures anyway, but they might actually become even more important in future if you're using HLE. So what you should take away from this is really that as if you're using any kind of data structure, they are most probably a candidate for using HLE, and therefore they can probably in future be used completely in parallel but different threads at the same time. But it requires actually work, not only work by using the appropriate prefix for the mutex operation. That's only a small part. You also have to make sure that the data structure by itself is inviting itself to actually be used in an HLE environment. Plus, it also should ideally have some internal checks in it that you're not running into capacity problems. If you're running into capacity problems of the cache, so if the chains are too long, etc., the operation will just be aborted and restarted under the lock, which is perhaps in some situations worse than what we have today, where we potentially have an optimization using reader-writer locks. So it's something which, HLE is something which will be easy to use, easy enough to use, but it requires at least a little bit of thinking. There are a couple of problems which are coming with it, though. So I already alluded to this a couple of times. The mechanism is not working on individual bytes in the memory. It's working on cache lines, 64 bytes. So with that, you, of course, can potentially run into problems. So for instance, what the hash table implementation which I had there, if every single hash table element or has only 4 bytes, is only 4 bytes in size, then the elements at offset 2 and at offset 5 are on the same cache line. And you actually would not have seen the same results as we have shown you there. Instead, you have to actually design the data structure so that you keep the cache line size of 64 bytes in mind to enable more parallelism. So you also have the potential for fault sharing. So, for instance, if the memory for the hash table is adjacent to a variable which is completely unrelated, which might be modified somewhere else. So as soon as this one variable, which is adjacent to the hash table, is modified, every single operation on the hash table, at least the entries which are part of the cache line, will fail. So it's even more important than to actually optimize for fault sharing. So you have to look at the data structures, put the elements which you need together, compact them as much as possible, and also avoid anything which can abort the instruction. So aside from capacity problems, it also means you cannot do any system calls in it. You also have to avoid everything which is trapping into the kernel altogether, things like page faults, etc. So all these kind of things have to be taken into account. Good news is that usually this is limited to people who are actually implementing data structures at this low level. So hopefully for everyone else, it's been done automatically. But at some point, everyone who looks for performance wants to know these details and actually look at them. So I've talked already quite a lot of time about the HLE part. Let's talk about the transactional memory side now. And I already said there's a paper written by Maurice Hurley a long time ago, 1991. That's the fundament. That's the beginning of the whole story. So 1991, it's a long time. So 21 years now, and it took us too long to actually get something in there. The good news is we now have this HLE part or the RTM part and the Intel process coming along, but we have now for quite a longer time people have been working on actually software transaction memory. And this is what is actually needed to make this possible. So let's first step back. So why do we talk about transaction memory? So the term obviously comes from the same source as the term transaction used in databases. In databases, a transaction is an operation which is made visible all at the same time, which consists of many smaller individual operations. So adding elements to multiple tables at the same time, or modifying elements in different tables at the same time, all the changes are made available atomically at one time. Nobody can see any intermediate results. This is what transactions are about, and this is also what we get the transaction memory support in programming languages for. So good news is that we have actually support for this kind of thing in the high-level programming languages now. So if you are interested in this, don't even come to talk to me. So here in the front row is actually one of the guys who wrote this code. So bother him, not me, so he knows much more about this than I do. So I'm just presenting this here. So going back to the example and the problem space which I talked about before, what do we do if we want to actually insert a node, insert something into a list, etc.? How do we handle locking, etc., etc.? And in a C++ world, what we are oftentimes doing is code like you can see here now on the slide, where where we're using a guard variable, which takes implicitly a lock, and as soon as we are leaving the frame which contains the guard variable, it is automatically unlocked, etc., and therefore everything performed inside the syntactic area here is done under the protection of the lock. So how would we do this now with transaction memory? And the good news is the change is absolutely minimal. So we have now a new keyword, whether they are with in this form or whether there are still some underscores in front of it, I actually don't know in the moment. So we have a keyword now, assume TM atomic, which introduces a new region after this. So it is followed by a single instruction or by a syntactic block. And the semantic is very similar to what you saw with the guard. Everything which is executed as part of this region, which is protected by TM atomic, is done atomically. But one thing, the big difference here, which you should recognize, is that we are not specifying any lock. We're just saying, do this atomically. So how is this implemented? How is this implemented in general? So the The runtime environment, if you're using software transaction memory, and by the way, you can do this already with GCC 4.7 today. So GCC 4.7 has a new flag, -f gnu-tm. If you use that, you can compile this code. And if you do that, the runtime environment, which is attached to the software transaction memory support, will keep track of every single memory access which is done under the protection of this TM atomic. So there's some additional code being generated to do that, which means that if you're using software transaction memory, the whole code runs a lot slower than it does in native mode, which makes it less attractive for certain situations, but it means that we can take advantage of all the benefits of what transaction memory is bringing us. And this is actually quite a handful. So we don't have to do any explicit locking in these kind of situations. So we have in this TM with this TM atomic keyword, not a lock itself, a lock object is specified. Everything is implicit. At the same time, this means that situations where the lock is unnecessarily acquired because there's either no other threat around or all other threats are doing something completely different, which is not disturbing any of the memory locations with which transaction memory is actually handling in this case. In this case, concurrency is not disturbed. Everything is running in parallel as much as possible, so limited by the implementation. The implementation or the specification for TM in C++ is even exception safe. So there's all kinds of tricky stuff built in the specification for the C++ TM part to allow us to write to use exceptions. And the most important part is that from day one, all the extensions, all the ABIs, more importantly than even the extensions, were designed so that we can completely transparently take advantage of hardware support for transaction memory if and when it should arrive. And the when has now been answered. Next year we get RTM. RTM is the second part of the Haskell instruction set extension, which is directly targeted to allowing us to implement transaction memory, allowing us to implement a TM atomic keyword in a more efficient way. So how is this actually being done? And for that, unfortunately, I have to go back to a little bit more assembly code, but I've made it easier for you. So I've actually come up with a couple of mappings here. So it's actually pretty simple to actually follow the program now. So this is, if you compile this code with some form of GCC, which I have used in this case, you come out with this code a little bit more annotated. So I don't have to go into all the details. The impressive part is that, in theory, if we should get now a version of an RTM-enabled compiler, we might actually get code extended just a tiny little bit, and that is with me looking like this. So we have a couple of new instructions, xbegin, xend, and there are a couple more of them, xabort and xtests, which are not really that important to mention here. If you're interested in this, read the specification. But in general, it says xbegin is a new instruction which says I'm beginning a transaction memory region here. It takes a parameter, which is an address of a label of some code somewhere. I'm going to talk about this in a second. And that's the xend instruction which says I'm done. I'm done with the transaction, commit everything. So that's it. With that, the CPU is simply put into the mode of saying, well, I'm part of a transaction. And every single memory operation which the CPU is executing in the meantime is marked as being part of a transaction and handled in a very similar way to what I described in the HLE examples. So cache lines are loaded, they're marked with the transaction flag. If you get an RFO request for a cache line, which is part of a transaction, you get an aborted transaction, etc. All this kind of thing applies the same. So it's even possible to mix and match RTM, so the XBegin instruction, and use HED instruction internally. So this will all work. It will all work at the level that only the outermost RTM or HED instruction will actually could do the commit. So it's actually what's called flattening of the transaction memory hierarchy there, basically. So that's it. So it's actually pretty simple. So the instruction you see at the very top is only something which might be part of the infrastructure. For instance, if you have a very simple implementation of the abort handler. So in case anything goes wrong as part of the transaction, unlike the HED instruction, we are getting at some point just restart. Not jump to immediately to the XBegin instruction, but instead the restart will actually start at the abort instruction, which you can see there. So if we at any point in time the XEnd instruction fails or anything in the middle, it will jump to the abort code, which can do some things. And here we have a lot more flexibility than with the HLE part. The HLE instruction will just start with actually doing the locking and not eliding the locking. With the RTM part, so the RTM instruction now, when we are jumping to the abort instruction, there are some registers filled with error codes, for instance. In this case, the RAX register, for instance, is filled with an error code. And we can test for things. For instance, if this is a capacity problem, a bit is set. If this is due to a system call or something like this, a certain bit is set, etc. So the abort handler can make intelligent decisions. Does it make sense to actually try doing the locking again? So, for instance, if you have to abort a transaction because of a system call, it most likely doesn't make any sense to retry again because it will again run into a system call, which means the transaction gets aborted again. So this by itself is a main thing, but it also introduces a big problem in that what do we do if we recognize that we cannot restart the code which is using RTM? In that case, we have to provide an alternative. And this is one of the biggest problems which exist when RTM support and will be added to GCC, and that is that we actually have to clone the code in two different versions. We have to have one version which is using the RTM instruction as it is here, and this is probably, if the machine supports it, the preferred solution because this code runs at least as fast as the code which we have today. Perhaps a little bit faster even. But the STM code, as I already mentioned, will run slower. But we have to generate a second version of this code which is using the STM instructions because we can potentially run in situations where we cannot use RTM, either because the CPU doesn't support it or more, even if it supports RTM. In these situations, if we have an unrestartable situation like system calls, then we have to fall back on the STM solution. So there are lots of details which have to be fleshed out to actually do that, to make this possible. There has to be some form of interoperability of the RTM and the STM part so that you are not creating any problems if both of them are used at the same time. So hopefully we can assume that these kind of things will be ironed out. And yeah, so if you're interested in this, come to Refund at some point. We have one of the guys who are working on this hopefully talk about this. So the good news is that there is on the horizon a technology so that we can actually implement what I've shown you at the as the example with the TM and Tonic part, mostly in hardware, and run with reasonable speed, probably even at least as good as we have it today. And what does it bring us now, finally? So I already said we don't have to do any explicit locking. But this is it's only part of the story. The bigger thing is actually that it allows us to sanely implement composition finally. This is the problem which I mentioned at the beginning when I was talking about the differences between explicit and implicit locking and the problems of implicit locking. What do you do if you have two related operations, an insert here and delete here, if they happen to do atomically? The good news is that with TM support, we can actually do that now. So If we just put, in this case, I'm looking at a C++ data structure, looking for a certain element of a list or whatever it is, some container. If we find it, I'm adding it to another data structure, I'm removing it from a second data structure. And if we would not have TM support, we have to do locking, either in this case around this, but we have to also make sure that every single user of the list L1 and L2 are using the lock. If most users are not using both lists at the same time, we want to have fine-grained locking. Then we have to use a separate lock for L1 and for L2, in which case we might run into the ABBA problem of the deadlock problem, etc., and the whole nightmare, which I explained at the beginning, exists. With transaction memory, we don't have to do any of that. We just say, transaction memory region here, do this in an atomically safe way. And that's it. And even if the individual data structures, for instance, the functions, the find function, the push front function, the erase function, implicitly also use transaction memory to secure themselves, it still will work. So you can see at the end here, so I have a little potential code flow. So it means that we have the X begin, which is corresponding to the TM atomic instruction, and then we're calling it to the find function. The find function might have its own atomic region, at which point we have the CPU will have something akin to a reference counter, which now will jump to 2 because we are nested 2 levels inside the atomic regions, the transactions, which means that if we come at an XAND instruction inside the find implementation, it will only drop the reference counter from 2 to 1 and not to 0. It means that the transaction is not yet over, and that in XAND instruction will not actually terminate anything. It will just go through, the push can have its own X begin, X end, the erase again, and only if we are coming at the end of the TMA atomic region from the code at the top there, will finally, at the XAND instruction, the reference count drop to 0, at which point the transaction gets committed. So we have a very, very elegant solution now for the composability problems. Regardless of how we implement this, using implicit locking, explicit locking, as long as we are consistently using the same mechanism, all will fall into place. This will make it so much easier to actually do the operations correctly. So we don't have to do any locking anymore. So just imagine in future we can have every single container out there doing its own implicit locking using a TM atomic regions. And if we have to do operations on more than one container, we just contain them into its own atomic region and it will work. While if you just need correctness of an individual instruction, for instance, an individual call to find something like this, then the implicit locking itself will do, and you don't have to do any locking yourself, any use of it, a TM atomic yourself. So this finally will actually get us to the point which I mentioned at the beginning. We actually revolutionized at that point the way locks are, well, actually parallelized code is written. We don't have to rely on locks anymore. We don't run into the problems. This will make it actually so easy that more people can write parallel code. And this is actually also one of the things which is motivating the code even on software transaction memory. So if someone cannot write any parallel code and runs a serial piece of code on a machine which perhaps has 8 or 16 cores on it, can suddenly write code using transaction memory, which might be 60% slower than the normal code, it will still run faster in the end if it can use more cores. So the parallelization will actually take care of this. And therefore, really, transaction memory will revolutionize, hopefully, the way we are writing code. And it will be attractive when it comes to the hardware transaction memory support, because then we actually get most of the time, hopefully, the same performance as we get with locking, without the complexities. Just as with HLE, we have a couple of problems there. Again, the cache line granularity is there, so I've been talking about this, but here it is even more severe. So while we might only get a couple of performance issues when we are having the wrong cache line sizes, or we're not keeping track of the cache line sizes, or if we are running into false sharing issues with HLE. With RTM, we actually might run into severe problems where the code will always fall back into the software transaction memory support, which is so much more expensive. So we really have to be careful when it comes to this. We have to make sure that the data structures are appropriately aligned in memory so that data elements are appropriately laid out in the definition of the data structures, et cetera. So this is going to be a little bit more tricky to actually get started. So we also have the problem that, as with HLE, we cannot do any system calls. While with HLE, this is not really that much of an issue. It's only meant to implement log-free data structures, which are, by its definition, really small operations on a small subset of memory locations. With TM Atomic, you can easily think that, well, why don't I put a printf here in the middle to debug something? Well, guess what? The printf might at some point then lead into a system call, which will not work. Will always abort the transaction. So this cannot really work. You have to be a little bit more agnostic, so have to be a little bit cognizant of what you're actually doing there, what code you're actually writing. So the work on TM has been going on for quite some time, but in reality, we have to admit that we haven't really gained that much experience with it, especially with the part which also is using hardware. So there have been some machines out there which have limited support for hardware transaction memory. So the Sun's Niagara chips at some point had these kind of things. There's a new machine from a company called Azul, which is providing a hardware JVM accelerator. So they had transaction memory support, but that's about it. The rest was academic work out there, and we haven't really gotten that much. So we have to still see what we actually can get with this, and it will take some time to optimize everything. So this comes especially for the abort handlers. So at least I haven't really yet seen any discussion as to how to best write the abort handlers. Do we have to actually allow the developer of the code some influence as to how the abort handlers are actually working? So I'm not sure whether the specifications even allow for these kind of things so far. And if we are running into problems with the RTM support or the HDM support in general, the SDM part, the software transaction memory emulation, is really, really slow. So it becomes really crucial that we increase the probability to actually succeed with the hardware, the RTM execution, the HDM support. And this might actually require a lot more feedback from the compilers, et cetera, actually be writing code like this successfully. All right, so I'm basically through with these kind of things. So that the HLE part is much better understood. The RTM part requires us to actually, in most cases, you can write assembly code yourself, but probably it will require compiler support, and there are a lot more integration with that. But we have all the tools now to increase the level of parallelization which are out there. So through the opportunistic execution which both of these technologies are providing us with, we get the potential of having a much higher level of parallelization in our programs and therefore taking advantage of all the cores which are out there. HLE by itself is fully backward compatible with existing processes. You can start writing your code right now and we'll see better performance. We can do away with artificial optimizations like read and write locks, but only if we can actually make the HLE or the RTM implementation actually succeed in almost all cases. Otherwise, we might actually get slowdowns. So composability will be solved by using transaction memory, which is a really, really big thing. I cannot stress how much. But again, the biggest problem is the cache line granularity, for which we have in the moment not a good solution for us. So we might get some support from the processor itself, who hopefully is providing us with information about these kind of things when things are going wrong, so at least performance counters, etc., will indicate situations where we have problems. But how do we handle with this? How do we handle this feedback? How do we handle the processor runtime saying something goes wrong here and recompile the code appropriately? I think that's still an open problem. So there's really not that much experience in this. It will take you a year. In a year from now, you will be able to get your hands on these kind of processes. By that time, hopefully, the compiler developers will have to already a couple of months experience with these kind of processes, and therefore, we might actually have something usable by that time. All right, that was it. If you have any questions, I'm told there is a microphone here.
For your talk and your insight on these locking techniques. Thank you. So, are there any questions? I guess there must be.
Oh. Yes.
Okay, maybe it's a bit of a naive question, but the way I understood LHE and HLE, sorry, it's working on the L1 cache. So how does that work in like a multi CPU system? Like,
well, it will work in a multi CPU system just as running threads which belong to the same process on this kind of system. That's all implemented using the MACI cache protocol. So imagine you have two threads running in the same process, accessing therefore the same address space, and why do they currently work? Why does accessing the same memory location from two threads work? This is because the caches are synchronizing themselves. There's this MACI protocol, which is a cache coherency protocol, and the TM part is just piggybacked on top of that. It's just a tiny little extension. It's just hooking into this RFO request, which I mentioned. So I could have talked about this in length, so I've written a little paper a couple of years ago about just the involvement of memory in this. So if you read about this, also has a section about transaction memory and how it is piggybacked on top of MACI.
Okay, thank you.
Ulrich, you referred to the Intel upcoming solutions. What about AMD, for example?
AMD hasn't publicly said anything. The only thing they have said recently is that they are going to ARM.
Any more questions? All here in this area?
So, again, about this HLE, right? Who's generating this X-acquire, X-release instructions? Or is there any compiler support needed for that? Or how are, I mean, they were shown there in the assembler snippets, yeah. But...
Well, there is support in very recent GCC versions to actually admit this as part of built-ins. So we already had built-ins for things like compare and exchange, and now you can use them in a normal fashion, have an additional parameter which says lock elision. Then it will create the appropriate prefixes. This is probably how you would how the authors of their structures, et cetera, will use this for the time being. So there will not be an automatic compiler support. So this is a semantic change to some extent. So it's not that the compiler automatically will be able to insert these prefixes. It has to be done by the author of the code. But if you imagine something like the C++ standard library, they will just change the code where they're currently using the built-ins for the cache instruction and just add these parameters.
Okay, one more final question. We are a bit over time already.
Yeah, about TM atomic operation. So, for me, it looks more natural to have some kind of a function attribute for it from a syntactical point of view.
So do you mean the TM atomic keywords?
Yeah. Yep. So like,
you still can still
like an attribute for
you
functions.
Can still do that. So this gives you flexibility. So The TM atomic is followed by a statement. If you say TM atomic x equals function call, you get exactly that.
And one more question about this TM atomic. It looks like that removing the explicit locking makes the code unportable to other architectures.
So can you speak up a little bit?
Removing explicit locking,
yeah,
replacing it with TM atomic, so it makes code unportable to other architectures. Is it true? No, so for example, not to ARM or PowerPC? Whatever.
Well, to some extent, it will make code on these kind of architectures a little bit less. But as you hopefully have seen in the way I've written the code there, you could probably with some preprocessor magic abstract out the use of TM Atomic and use the good thing on the reasonable architecture and use the crappy locking for the crappy embedded crap. So then you can actually use the same piece of code.
Okay, that concludes the talk, so thanks again for your talk.
Sure.